This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to discuss a book that I think is really revolutionizing the way that we look at, I hate to use the word, dieting. You know, we don't generally talk about diet books here on Intelligent Medicine because there's a profusion of them. But this is a book that is highly authoritative. It's written by a practicing endocrinologist and researcher at Boston Children's Hospital who is very, very highly credentialed. He is professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. And he has written a book entitled Always Hungry, which I think really hits the mark in terms of what's wrong with our current approach to losing weight. Dr. David Ludwig is an MD, PhD. He's a professor of nutrition, as I said, at Harvard School of Public Health. And he has been featured in the New York Times and on NPR, ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN. The book is really a sensation. So without further ado, here's Dr. David Ludwig. Dr. Ludwig, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Great being with you today, Dr. Hoffman.
So, okay, well, what's the central premise here? Because it's an arresting title, Always Hungry. Congratulations.
Okay.
I think you got my attention.
Okay, good. Well, how about this for getting your attention? Overeating doesn't make you fat, not over the long term.
Okay, well, wait a minute. That's you're shattering the orthodoxy here.
Yes, we're going to try it again. Overeating doesn't make you fat over the long term. The process of getting fat makes you overeat. So let me try to support that. Well, of course, if you force feed an individual or an experimental animal, so as has been done in research for decades, they'll gain weight temporarily. But what happens, you know, in the clinical studies? The individual being force fed loses all interest in food, and their metabolism speeds up in the body's attempt to get rid of those excess calories. In fact, people in force-feeding studies are just as miserable as those in starvation or underfeeding studies. Once the protocol ends, they eat less, and their weight naturally drifts down right to where it started. So, we understand through years of research now that body weight is controlled more by biology than willpower. Over the short term, we can control our weight, but over the longer term, the body fights back and tends to return weight right back to where it started. Now, that raises the huge question, why does weight seem to be going up every year after year in the United States over the last 40 years, resulting in this obesity epidemic? And the answer to that is the purpose of my book, to explore that and to look at an alternative approach to weight control based on the new science of understanding food biology and body weight.
You acknowledge in the book being inspired to some degree by the works of Dr. Robert Atkins, the late Dr. Robert Atkins, and Barry Sears. They were sources of inspiration for you, and you actually have a personal story because you, although you are a nutrition researcher and an obesity expert, you were having trouble optimizing your weight when you were, I believe it was in your 30s, correct?
Well, I finished medical school like so many medical students with virtually no training in nutrition, which in retrospect was a blessing in disguise because I didn't get inculcated in this calories in, calories out model of weight control, and we can talk about what the problem with that approach is. But I got interested in obesity research, joined a basic laboratory looking at the genetic factors that cause obesity using mice and rats as experimental models. Didn't really love working with those animals, but learned a lot about the biology of weight control. But at that time, and this is early in my career, just after my medical training or at the end of it, I was like so many Americans, gaining an extra pound or two a year. You know, I'd always been lean and pretty fit, but by my mid-30s, I was right at the cutoff for BMI leading into the overweight range. And at that time, I made a career change, continued obesity research, but got out of the animal laboratory into research involving humans, clinical research, and began to explore alternative ideas about nutrition and body weight, not based on calories in, calories out, all calories are alike, but instead as an endocrinologist, I had just finished my training in that area, as to how food affects our hormones, our metabolism, and literally the expression of genes throughout the body that can make all the difference between whether we feel full or hungry after a meal, whether we're gaining weight or losing weight, whether we're enjoying good health or suffering from chronic disease.
Well, that sort of gets to the idea of food not just as fuel, but as sort of information for our endocrine system, for our immune system, our nervous system as a whole, and varying the substrates, even if they're the same calories, sends different information to the body's systems.
Absolutely. And, you know, so what is driving this epidemic of obesity? We have to direct attention to the granddaddy of all weight gain hormones, and that's insulin. Now, insulin is the ultimate fat cell fertilizer. This is just endocrinology 101, well recognized for decades. If a child with type 1 diabetes, when that child first comes to attention and hasn't received insulin yet and his body isn't making enough insulin, he will have invariably lost weight, no matter whether he's eating 500 or 1,000 calories more than he needs. He can't gain weight. If you give that child the right amount of insulin, weight gain trajectory returns to normal. Give him too much insulin, and he'll predictably gain weight. So insulin is critical in understanding whether we gain or lose weight. And if you don't have diabetes, the fastest way to lower insulin to levels that make weight control easier is to reduce the consumption of processed carbohydrates. And we're talking about all of those foods that flooded into our diet during those low-fat years beginning in the 1970s, the low-fat craze. Remember, the ultimate version of that was the first food guide pyramid, with all fats at the top to be consumed sparingly, and a load of these processed carbohydrates, 6 to 11 servings a day, mostly processed carbohydrates at the base, grain products, and the like. Yeah, so we've started eating less fat. As we were told, our carbohydrate intake went way up. That increased the levels of insulin in the body, and that insulin has programmed us for weight gain. So with high insulin, those fat cells feast. They go on calorie storage overdrive. They take in the lion's share of calories from the meal, leaving too few for the rest of the body. You know, ironically, we think of obesity as a state of excess, but it's really a state of deprivation, of starvation to the body. The brain sees not enough calories in the blood for its metabolism and the needs of the rest of the body. That's why we get hungry. If you simply cut back on calories, as we're told to do, you actually make that situation worse, explaining why it's so difficult for most people to stay on low-calorie diets.
You actually contrast sensational versus sustainable weight loss. Presumably, your program, the Always Hungry program, is about sustainable weight loss. But one can achieve dramatic weight loss, lose 40 pounds in 40 days. But what happens then?
Right. Well, first I guess I should tell you at the end of the story, you asked me about my personal experience.
Yep.
And so I just came upon these ideas right, in my mid-30s, just as my BMI was reaching that overweight level of 25. And I used myself as the first guinea pig. I made all these changes. I increased fat intake basically doubled my fat intake. Now, this was in the 1990s, at the height of the low-fat craze. So people
that was heresy in those days.
I was acting crazy. So, I doubled my fat intake, got rid of all of the processed carbohydrates, although didn't eliminate all carbohydrates. I still ate plenty of whole fruits, vegetables, beans, and carbohydrate from other natural sources. Ate a little more protein than I was getting, but not an extremely high protein diet. And I did this without an attempt to lose weight. I was merely trying to experiment how I would feel. And I noticed changes in my experience to food and the sense of satiety, that sense of fullness after the meal. I noticed it almost immediately, within the first day or two. I got more satisfaction from the meal. I stayed full much longer. A little bit of food went much further than it used to. My cravings for processed carbohydrate vanished, and I started losing weight. I lost about a pound or two a week, and after a few months, I was back down to my fighting weight when I was 18 or 20 years old, and very athletic in high school and college. And that, again, without restricting calories, without counting calories, without hunger, or without restricting all carbohydrates, as the old very low carbohydrates would have it. And that experience propelled me into my career in clinical research and, to this very day. That's the line of research I'm now doing.
And this is not merely theoretical, because your book is full of really exciting testimonials from people who follow the Always Hungry Solution, which is what you title your program. Because you have the resources of Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health behind you, and you were able to conduct a moderate-sized study with 237 women and men, a 16-week pilot study. And what were people saying?
Yeah, well, let me emphasize that the pilot test wasn't a true research study. We did it to get feedback on the program as we were developing it last year prior to publication, fine-tune the recipes, also get stories and experiences about where people, how they succeeded, where they ran into challenges, and how they overcame them. All of these anecdotes in the book are absolutely real. We include people's real names, age, and location, last initial but real first name.
And they say almost unanimously it's the real deal. It really does seem to turn things around for them.
We got very good feedback. We're actually running in real time now, a Facebook community since the book was published in January. We already have over 2,500 people involved in the community, where they're sharing recipes and giving each other support. And my wife, Dawn, who is a gourmet natural food chef, she did the recipes and meal plan in the book, oversees the support group. It's called the Official Always Hungry Book Community on Facebook. So your listeners are welcome to join us. We take all comers.
Very cool.
But in addition to the pilot test, the program is based on dozens of research studies that have come from my group, and hundreds of research studies from other groups around the world dating back literally a century. And I'll tell you a research study or two if you'd like at this point.
Sure. Yeah, let's hear what the scientific basis is for this.
Okay, well, we're trying, the premise is, as I mentioned, overeating doesn't make you fat. The process of getting fat makes you overeat, but all calories are not alike. The calories have profoundly different impacts on our hormones, metabolism, and likelihood to gain weight or lose weight. So to address this notion head on, our calories are alike, all calories alike, we took 21 young adults who had overweight or obesity, and we reduced their weight by 10 to 15%. So that would be like 25 to 30 pounds for the typical participant. So quite a bit of weight, and that will put the body under stress. And we know that people will typically after that get hungry, and their metabolism would tend to slow down. Then we stabilize their weight at that new lower level and put them for a month at a time on three different diets. So we had the conventional low-fat diet, 20% fat, 60% carbohydrate. At the other side of the spectrum, we had the Atkins diet with a whopping 60% fat. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle,
almost a ketogenic diet, virtually no carbs.
In that direction, although it wasn't ketogenic because the Atkins diet has so much protein. Protein is
It's gluconeogenic. In other words, you can make sugar out of protein. Okay.
That's right. You can, and that's why at traditional Atkins diet levels, you don't typically get keto. You don't develop high levels of ketones, and we, in fact, tested for that, and that was the case. They had slightly higher ketones, but it wasn't in the range that we would consider ketogenic, and their ketogenic diets are very interesting and a whole different, but it gets into a whole different level of physiology. But anyway, for this study, we looked at low-fat, very high-fat Atkins, 60%, or kind of a Mediterranean low-glycemic index diet in the middle. Mm-hmm. And we found that, as expected, calories burned or metabolic rate plummeted with the weight loss on the low-fat diet, dropped by more than 400 calories a day, suggesting that these individuals were really under metabolic stress and their body was going into starvation mode, trying to hold on to those calories. Mm-hmm. When your metabolic rate drops that much, it's going to be exceedingly difficult to keep losing weight. On the Atkins diet, metabolic rate didn't decline at all. It remained exactly where it was despite the weight loss.
So that's a little better.
The Mediterranean diet was sort of in the middle. So that difference of about 325 calories a day is like an hour of moderately vigorous physical activity without lifting a finger. Another way to think about that amount is it's sufficient if that were a persistent long-term effect to explain much of the obesity epidemic, that 325 mm-hmm. calories a day. Mm-hmm. So again, this study suggests that the kind of calories going in affect the number of calories going out of the body. And that observation is in defiance of the conventional calorie in, calorie out model of weight control.
It almost seems to violate the laws of thermodynamics. But, you know, we're not cars. We're not steam engines. We're complex physiological units, and there's a lot of endocrine regulation of our energy processing.
That is the exactly right point. That the law of thermodynamics that gets oft quoted, you know, all energy can't be created or destroyed, calories in, calories out, still applies. But it doesn't take into account the fact that humans aren't toaster ovens or steam engines, as you say. We're dynamic biological systems. When we eat less, when the body experiences calorie deprivation, it's not inert. It fights back. It fights back with rising hunger, but it also fights back with lowering energy expenditure, and that those responses really practically invalidate the notion that all calories are alike with regard to body weight control.
So in addition to insulin, which is a big factor here, you cite the role of inflammation, or as you title it in the book, angry fat. What's up with that?
Right. Okay, well, we call these the twin metabolic troublemakers, high insulin levels and chronic inflammation, and then they tend to go together. So the sequence of events described in part one of the book, part one is the science, about 100 pages, and tried to write it in a way that would be accessible to the public, but also credible to the researchers and the physicians out there. It's got hundreds of references in the back for people with the scientific bent. So as we go through the science, I explain the first step is with consumption of too much processed carbohydrates, we raise insulin in the body. That insulin directs fat cells to hoard too many calories. So they feast, the rest of the body starves, and we start gaining weight. As a result of that, we then get hungry. We get hungrier because there aren't enough calories hanging around for the rest of the body. The brain does what it's supposed to do, makes us hungry. Hard to resist. If you resist, your body goes into starvation mode. That's a battle between mind and metabolism. We can't win. And sooner or later, we're going to just overeat, especially of those processed carbs, because we'll want those the most. They raise blood sugar the fastest. And those calories make us feel better temporarily, but they keep promoting weight gain. At a certain point, the fat cells reach a state where they can no longer handle efficiently those excess calories. And for some people, that is when they're really obese. For others, it's at a relatively low body weight. And
you describe that as a TOFI, T-O-F-I.
That's right. Thin outside, fat inside. And we know that people, you know, that there are many people with normal body weight who develop type 2 diabetes or cardiovascular disease at an early age, although, of course, obesity is the dominant risk factor there. One can still be at risk despite a normal BMI. And so that transition point from relatively healthy fat that's compensating into inflamed fat where the immune system rushes in because the fat cells are not working properly and they're responding to what think is an infection, the immune cells, but isn't, creates this state of angry fat that we call it, which spews these inflammatory substances, interleukins and other cytokines throughout the body, causing inflammation in the blood vessels, leading to atherosclerosis, in the liver, compounding metabolic disease, in the lungs, you know, perhaps explaining the connection between obesity and asthma, and even in the brain, and in the hypothalamus, which creates a vicious cycle where those centers that would normally respond to satiety hormones like leptin can't. So, you know, we get into this vicious cycle of increasing hunger, weight gain, and chronic inflammation. The fastest way to reverse that process is by eliminating the processed carbohydrates and replacing them with actually delicious, rich, high-fat foods. So you don't miss the carbohydrates. These high-fat foods like olive oil, nuts, avocado, even dark chocolate, don't raise insulin levels much at all. And so you get the calories coming in without the insulin response. They help the fat cells calm down, open up, and release their calories back into the body. When that happens, this process of weight gain and chronic inflammation reverses naturally.
Okay, well, you set the stage beautifully for today's discussion. In part two of our discussion of the new book, Always Hungry, with our guest, Dr. David Ludwig, we're going to take a look at what the actual program looks like. We're going to take a deep dive into the Always Hungry solution, which is outlined in this great book. The science is for real. It's well substantiated. And there's a pathway to weight loss that this book outlines in detail. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.